rest of that.
Why? I know.
Let the record show that the Hess meeting convened at 3:08, and members present were Representative Keller, Representative Faircloth, Representative Gardner, Representative Seaton, and myself, Representative Wilson, and that our staff today is Debbie Tillinghast, who's our recording secretary, Jake Wade, who is our LIO monitor, and Becky Rooney, who is our committee aide. And before we start, make sure in this room, cell phones, even if you have them on vibrate, interfere with the electronics over here. So if you could turn them off, we would sure appreciate it. And we have three bills on our agenda today, SJR 11, Senate Bill 241, and Senate Bill 119, and we're going to do them in that order. So, Senator, Representative Sisnes just joined us. And Senator Wilikowski, will you come forward and present your resolution?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a resolution that urges the United States Congress to ensure adequate funding for veterans' health care. There have been at least 20 other states that have passed similar resolutions. It's passed unanimously in the Senate with 17 co-sponsors. And as you know, the United States Department of Veterans Affairs provides medical care for veterans who have risked their lives to protect the nation. And the department provides a wide range of specialized services to meet the unique needs of veterans, including treatment and care for spinal cord injury, blindness, traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, amputation injuries, mental health, substance abuse, conditions requiring long-term care. In addition, the department trains healthcare personnel, conducts medical research, and serves as backup for the United States Department of Defense, supporting communities in time of crisis. Unfortunately, the agency has been consistently underfunded. The General Governmental Accountability Office, the nonpartisan agent of the Congress, report in 2005 highlighted the lack of resources and staffing available to the Veterans Administration for processing an increasing backload of veterans claims. And funding for the department lags behind both medical inflation and the increased demand for services. Just as an example, the enrollment for veterans health care increased 134% between fiscal years 1996 and 2004, yet funding only increased 34% during the same period when adjusted for 1996 dollars. The resolution professes our profound gratitude for the sacrifices made by veterans who suffer from medical and mental problems resulting from injuries sustained while serving the United States. And most importantly, it urges the United States Congress to ensure adequate funding for veterans' health care. And I ask you to respectfully support this resolution. Thank you.
Well, I really think that it's really important for Alaska, especially since we have more veterans than any of the other states do. So, anyway, looks like we have a question from Representative Sisson.
Yes, thank you very much. This very much needed resolution, actually, the netting adequate funding is important. Had you considered mentioning here the percentage that Alaska enjoys of veterans compared to other, I guess, per capita compared to other states?
It's obviously something that I think we have the highest percentage of veterans in the United States. It's a point well taken, and we did work with several of the service organizations, and we have their unanimous support for this resolution. In crafting this, it's not something that they specifically asked for, but if the committee would like that, I would certainly not object to that.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you. The other thing that I actually forgot to add is the fact that, I don't know what the facts are in terms of, but it sounded like Alaska also is having a number and maybe significant percentage of veterans that are coming out of the present, our present conflict, and going to up the costs very possibly dramatically given the situations they go back to. Is that something that might be useful to talk about in this, or at least to have backup?
Again, I'd leave that to the committee's discretion. But you are correct. There is a high percentage of veterans who are coming back now, particularly with brain injuries, post-traumatic stress disorders, I think higher than in past. We do mention in the, let's see, the fourth whereas line 12 through 15 on page 1, some of the things that they're being provided treatment for. But no, we didn't get into those specifics. And we did actually model this after several other pieces, resolutions that were passed by some other states. But I'd, again, certainly be open to this committee's input.
Representative Sisson, a follow-up.
Yes, just as a follow-up, I know myself, I think probably the piece of legislation is good, and it just will be nice things that we can say to boost it on the floor.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions, and we don't have anybody, but we do have some people online that would like to testify, so if it's all right with the committee, I'll go right to testimony from the ones that are online. Russell Kell, are you online?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yes, yes, I'm representing the Vietnam Veterans of America at this hearing.
Go ahead and give us your testimony.
Yes, ma'am. Assured funding will assist in ensuring veterans are healthy enough to pursue education programs and pursue employment. In the past, less than adequate funding by the United States Congress has resulted in denied or delayed medical treatment for veterans otherwise entitled. When medical treatment is denied or delayed, veterans are much less likely to be able to pursue productive educational benefits or productive employment. The negative results of this lack of pursuit are much more apparent later in life and in years ahead. Passing assured funding will be the advantage of all Alaskans, and that, if necessary, medical care for needy veterans, when necessary medical care for needy veterans is denied by VA, many times Medicaid will pay this medical bill. Reduction in Medicaid payments by the state will be in everybody's interests as long as the medical treatment, the need of medical treatment by veterans is still provided. And relative to the percentage, we do have the highest percentage of veterans per capita, but even more important, we're one of the very few states where the percentage of veterans relative to the overall state population is anticipated to increase. So it'll be even more important that we do the right thing in the state of Alaska. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Russell. And do you have that written down by any chance?
Well, not that anybody can read. Except for maybe me.
Okay, thank you. That's fine then. If anybody does have it written down, if you would fax it to us at 465-3175. And Tim Wheeler, you're next.
I'm Chairman. My name's Tim Wheeler. I'm the Secretary of the Alaska Veteran Business Alliance. I support SJR 11. We need to make sure that we have adequate funding for all veterans, especially the many wounded veterans that have come back or will be coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. This is an obligation to make sure that all veterans will be taken care of. I request immediate passage of SJR 11. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Kevin McGee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, distinguished committee members. I continue to stress the fact that politics continues to trump veterans' needs when it comes to funding and resource allocation at the Department of Veterans Affairs. AFGE Local 3028 renews its call for assured mandatory funding of the VA healthcare system after another round of continuing resolutions and political power plays delayed the arrival of much-needed funding increases for the Veterans Health Administration, as well as dollars needed to hire new claims processors at the Veterans Benefits Administration. AFGE Local 3028 also urges increased oversight of VA spending to ensure that the substantial increases in its FY 2008 budget are spent on veterans' needs rather than excessive management bonuses and illegal outsourcing. other AFGE Local 3028 legislative priorities, including improving VBA training and restoring the bargaining rights of VA's healthcare professionals. I wish to reemphasize that AFGE Local is in full support of SRJ 11 because as the federal workers who take care of Alaska's most precious resource, Alaska's veterans, we feel an obligation that those men and women who have risked their lives and well-being to provide a level of safety and security to all Alaskans, regardless of personal status. As Alaskans, we have a moral obligation to insist that our veterans, as well as all of America's veterans, are provided the best medical care that can be provided to them without the worry of whether adequate funding will be available to provide those needs. In conclusion, this year, AFG Local 3028 will seek congressional action, both state and federal, on numerous fronts to enhance the VA's ability to meet the needs of all veterans. A more predictable, systematic funding process through assured funding, mandatory funding, a stronger healthcare workforce through the restoration of bargaining rights, a reduction in the claims backlog through better training and staffing, greater oversight of questionable attempts to outsource VA functions and healthcare, as well as expanded veterans' employment opportunities. Thank you for the opportunity to present my position. Thank you.
Kevin, what does AFGE stand for?
American Federation of Government Employees.
Thank you. Okay. John Yeoman?
Yes. Hello, Madam Chair. John Yeoman's here. Service Disabled Veterans Small Business Alliance. I can only piggyback on what my colleagues here has spoke on, but as a frontline individual with the health care providers for Veterans Affairs for the past 24 years, I can assure you there's a dying need for this bill to pass. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else online? That's all I have. Is there anyone else? No, no one else online. Okay. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify in this bill? Okay. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the sponsor.
Oh, just a second. Okay. I'm going to close testimony then. And Representative Gardner, proceeding.
Thank you. We have in our packet something called immediate release. I guess it's a press release from Moki Pratt Porter. And it looks like this. Only your copy doesn't have the yellow highlight on it. And the question that I have is this, that it says, to accommodate these goals, Rowan said, VVA, and that's the Vietnam Veterans of America, recommends an increase of $5.24 billion over fiscal 808. Of this amount, $1.3 billion should be dedicated to restoring access to priority 8 veterans who were temporarily barred from entering the system 5 years ago. And I understand the broad sense that as a nation we make a promise to people who sign up to serve that we will provide health care for them. I don't understand the specifics of that, how we can have veterans who are at a low priority and they're barred from getting health care services. Can you explain anything about that?
Yeah, well, there's a couple things going on. And a lot of the veterans that I've spoken with about health care have told me that when they enlisted or entered into the military armed forces, they were made promises that they would have health care for the rest of their lives. And a lot of the promises have been broken, quite frankly. Just in recent times, for instance, the government significantly increased the amount that veterans had to pay to go get medical services. So there were promises that were made, and because of inadequate funding, a lot of those promises have not been kept. This is on the federal level. And so we're asking, this resolution does two things. It expresses our appreciation for what they've done and the sacrifices they made, but also asks for adequate funding for veterans' health care.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Do I hear a motion?
Madam Chair?
Yes?
Yes, Kevin McGee here. I just want to clear something up, and it may assist Representative Gardner.
You know, Category 8 veterans are those veterans that have an income level of over $30,000 is where they top out at.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And we have closed, I appreciate the answer there, but we have closed public testimony, so. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find that really interesting. So I guess my question is, when we make a promise to provide health care to people who serve in the on the armed forces, do we say only if you're low income? Do we say only if you're injured, or do we say we'll do it? And that's something of a rhetorical question, unless someone has an answer.
Yeah. Well, it's obvious to me that anybody that is in any way, shape, or form risking their life for our country, that we need to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what my feelings are. Mm-hmm. So. Representative Faircloth.
Madam Chair, if it's your will, I'd like to move from committee Senate Joint Resolution 11, that's 25-LS0829/E. I don't see any fiscal notes, but with individual recommendations. Is there a fiscal note?
Zero. Fiscal note.
With attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Hearing no objection, so move.
Thank you,
Senator Lukowski. Okay, next on our agenda is House Bill or Senate Bill 241, University Reporting Teacher Training and Retention. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've asked Tim Lampkin to join me because I've got a closeout that I've got to go to in a few minutes, but appreciate your hearing this bill, Madam Chair. This is a result, this bill, a result of the Joint Legislative Education Funding Task Force that met over the summer. And Representative Seaton had the good fortune of being involved in that every time we met. There were several bills that came out of that, and this is one of them. It's what it does is to bring the university into a dialogue with the legislature on teacher training, and it requires a report from the university on the teacher workforce development in our state, specifically in reference to attracting, retaining, attracting, training, and retaining qualified public school teachers. What it does is to require that the Board of Regents, and I've got to say, often we don't have a direct communication with the Board of Regents. This would be one of the few times we really do communicate, have a dialogue with the Board of Regents. It requires the Board of Regents, not their employees, not their staff, to report to the education committees, or if education committees don't exist, though I hope they will because of other bills we passed, but if they don't, then to the HES committee. But anyway, the committees that have jurisdiction over education, and that has to happen on the 30th day of the legislative session. That will be an annual report, and then as you read through it, I know it might be a little confusing, but as you read through it, you'll see that in 2013, it becomes a biennial report every other year. What it does is send a very clear message that the legislature wants to look at what the University of Alaska and the Board of Regents are doing about the teacher shortage. And, I guess I don't know much more detail, but frankly, there's a lot of information that already exists in the university. If you look at the fiscal note, you see the university conducts Alaska Teacher Supply and Demand Report. It conducts a performance measuring report. It conducts an employment follow-up data, and then also there's the Alaska Teacher Placement and also the Alaska Teacher Mentoring Programs that provide this, have this information available as well. So the information is already there. We're not demanding they create a bunch of new information or do a lot more collecting of data, but I think it's extremely valuable that the university report to us, that the legislature should be brought into the loop on what's happening in a very important issue to all of us with teacher training and retention. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. And I don't see Representative Keller.
Senator Stevens, through the chair. I was wondering if the word retain in this report, I mean, what you envision there. The university, I can't envision anything that the university would do or does regularly that comes, I mean, it is easy for me to understand right off, to retain our teachers. And maybe the same thing on attract. I understand the university attracting them for training, you know, in specifically needed areas and that kind of thing, but it's more specifically the attention.
Thank you, Chair, Representative McKellar. It's really, this is an issue of reporting. So they report how the retention has been. They're not. It's not the university's job to retain the teacher, but it is the university's job to report to us what retention has been, if it's been successful, how successful, and what and working with the districts, what plans are there to improve teacher retention.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, then you wouldn't mind if we clarify that if the committee feels like it.
Let me ask Tim, who's been working on this, to, and I'm sorry, I should have said Gary Stevens, Mr. Carr, and this is Tim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Also, to clarify, I think one specific retention tool that's currently being used is this Alaska Statewide Mentor Project, which is a direct partnership between the University of Alaska and the Department of Education to help coach and literally mentor new teachers, freshman, sophomore-type teachers in their first year or three. So to answer that question, I think the mentor program is a good one for retention.
And I really I feel that the university can hold a play a big role in retention by making sure that they prepare students for lots of times in the remote rural areas where I think a lot of times teachers aren't prepared to go to that area, and I think that if the university really gets those students prepared, what to expect, you know, and also to be able to handle situations that might come up in a rural area that might not come up in an urban area. And so I think there is a role that the university has to play there that will make a difference with retention. And it's not teaching or not having the professor teach the same way they've been teaching for the last 20 years, but to make sure that they're up to date and that they're that what they're teaching is very pertinent to what their students are going to experience when they leave. And if they're lucky enough to get an urban position, they aren't going to have to worry about it. But the ones that aren't and that end up in those remote areas, they have a lot harder task, I think, than the ones in the urban areas. And so I think that really will make a difference is how they're prepared for it.
Certainly, although I believe some teachers out there might not consider it lucky to be in an urban area.
That could be. do I have any other questions? Representative Sisson?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question would also be kind of the depth of that report, because in fact, one of the things I think about in retention are oftentimes public policy that is created by the legislature in funding, as in benefits, the amount of money that's going to the school, those kinds of things. So would the report also include very possibly studies that would help the legislature in terms of long-term conditions like funding incentives for teacher retention, that kind of thing?
Through the chair, Representative Sisson, I believe it was the nature of the desire of the task force, if I'm not mistaken, to not limit the university in what it might report on to that extent. So I believe it would be fair to say that that would certainly be something within the realm of this report, potentially.
Thank you.
Representative Faircloth.
Madam Chair, with the help of your aide, I'm trying to pull my other file that I didn't bring with me from our previous discussion. But one of the concerns that I had, or that I still have, is that this report will be used to financially leverage an appropriation versus what I believe the issue is, and that is what are we doing inside of the system to retain it. And so I need to see my notes, and I'll hold with that.
Okay. Representative Roses.
Thank you. I just had a question on just a technical aspect of the bill. I noticed that the last line says, Section 5 says that Section 2 of this Act takes effect July 1st, 2012. And in Section 2 of the Act, we talk about that the Board of Regents will prepare and present to the legislative committees having jurisdiction over education, a biennial report, so on and so on. That language is exactly the same as what we have in Section 1. And Section 1, not having an effective date, goes into effect in 90 days. So what do we want, 90 days or 2012?
90 days.
I mean,
through the annual in the first one.
Through the chair, Representative Roses, the intent that was established in the Senate Education Committee was that for the first, 5 years or so, that this report be an annual report. We hear about it every single year.
Okay.
After which time it's presumed that the university or the teaching shortage gap might have diminished, and that it may no longer be necessary to hear about it every single year. That instead, at that time, effectively, it would be the first session of the 27th legislature, 26th, 2013. That then it would thereafter become a biannual report.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Keller.
I'll save it till we're discussing.
Okay. Yeah. All right. We have John Pugh, Chancellor from the University here, so we'll let him come up and testify where he's at with his bill. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, I'm John Pugh, the Chancellor of the University of Alaska Southeast. I understand that Cynthia Henry from the Board of Regents was supposed to be on. If she is, I would defer to her and then can come back, and then obviously she can speak to the supporter of the bill or not.
Yes, I am. This is Cynthia Henry in Fairbanks.
Go ahead, Cynthia.
Did you want me to testify or just give comments on this bill?
Well, go ahead and testify first, and then if we have any questions, we'll fire them.
Okay. I guess it's the position of the Board of Regents is that, you know, we are happy to comply or provide any kind of reports that your committee or the legislature would like to receive. Teacher education is a high priority for the University of Alaska, and so we're happy to participate in that discussion, work with the legislature in. There is a gap. We're not filling the vacancies across Alaska as well as we'd like to be. And so by working together, I think we can improve on closing that gap. And so I don't think there's any consternation on our side.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, just wanted to make sure that I was getting on the record that your interpretation is the same as ours, that where it says the regents shall prepare and present to the legislative committees having jurisdiction an annual report, you're envisioning that as an in-person or at least a teleconferenced report to the committees. Is that correct?
I think that's ideal. You know, we communicate better when we're sitting around the same table or testifying in person, I think is the ideal as far as a working relationship. And so I think that would be our goal. The regents always have a February meeting in Juneau. So logistically, if it could work out that takes place at that time, it saves, you know, transportation costs and all those sorts of things. But I think that's basically your call, I guess, how it fits into the legislative schedule, and we'd try to accommodate that. But I don't know if that's specified in the bill, how this report would be presented.
Tim, you have a...
Once again, this is Tim Lampkin. In Senate Education, having also myself served on the Board of Regents, I knew that the Regents come to Juneau every single February of the year, And so therefore we changed it that it would be within the 30th legislative day. That would accommodate their existing schedule and speak to continuing a zero fiscal note.
Wonderful. Any other questions for anybody? I have a question, and I think probably the committee was concerned. It says the report must include an outline of the university's past, current, and future plans to help close the gap between known teacher employment vacancies in the state and the number of state residents who complete teacher training. So I think they're probably thinking that it is a problem in Alaska, and if there's anything that the university can do to help with that, and that might, I don't even know, it might even be an extra class that they would take or something. I have no idea, but something that would, you know, maybe, you know, do you have anything to add to that, John?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think that I've made some notes on retention when some questions were coming up. I think that the university does have a place in trying to retain teachers. I do think that the districts have the primary responsibility for trying to retain teachers. However, as was mentioned earlier, we have partnered with the Department of Education for 4 years now with a mentoring program for first-year and second-year teachers throughout the state, which actually hires master teachers who work with these first and second-year teachers, really helping them through because it's the most critical period. If you look at all the research and data, most of the time you lose your teachers within the first 5 years that they're teaching. And, in fact, the first two are even worse than that, but within the first five, and then it really begins to slow down and people stay on once they get used to that profession and stay in it. So I think there is a place in mentoring. There's also a place in professional development activities, and I think, Madam Chair, you were kind of mentioning that. The university has a place to play in developing professional development activities that fit with the districts, work with the districts, to ensure that the teachers in general, but also first and second year teachers on are continuing their professional development, because just like, you know, an architect or an engineer or so on, this is the apprentice time, the first couple of years, and they continue to need professional development. You can't in a 4 year period or a year or two of certification classes get to a place where teachers an expert and ready to take that on as a career. So I think there is a place with professional development. And then thirdly, I think there is a place for the university to ensure that some of the students are being placed in rural Alaska. To mention about that, we actually have a program which we offer all the students to go out and have a placement in rural Alaska during their 1 year internship so that they can get experience rural Alaska and get some idea about that. And it has increased the number of our students who have been willing to go out and take teaching jobs in rural Alaska, and I think it will increase the retention of those teachers by having those placements take place in rural Alaska. We also have placements in rural Alaska. We have a unit at Craig on Prince of Wales Island. We have a unit in Dillingham. These kind of things, so that, in fact, students are taking their internships in rural Alaska. And I think that's a way of getting students to really see rural Alaska and get committed to it and stay.
Chancellor, I have another question myself here. With, you know, the kind of pairing up or the partnershiping of the department and the university, these mentors that have gone out, have they come back and made suggestions that maybe we need to zero in on different things or anything like that?
Actually, I think that there's two ways I think that gets back. Definitely the mentors have come back and provided input into what you need, you know, what the curriculum needs to be and what preparation needs to be. But the other places, for example, our master's art of teaching program, the student is literally placed the entire year in the classroom, and so we get feedback directly from those teachers to our supervisors in terms of whether that teacher is making the kinds of progress, but also what kinds of things that they're bringing into the classroom and how can that change. And those teachers are a part of the, you know, part and parcel of our whole program and our master's art of teaching, and that is true of other programs within the university of attempting to get that feedback. We also use a lot of teachers as adjunct faculty to actually teach in the classes. It's because, again, you're correct that not all the faculty have a continuous place back in the classroom, and so they can get to a place where you're a little staler if you're teaching at the university level, and I think that's very important. Although I would say that when I was the Dean of Arts and Sciences and Education at UAS, we did have faculty who took their sabbaticals to actually go back and teach in the classroom. That was, for many of them, the way they wanted to stay current. So that it does happen.
Do we have, I don't know if Alaska does, I know some states have a requirement that that they go at least and visit some of these classrooms, and does Alaska have anything?
I do not think that Alaska has a requirement to do that at this point. We have a requirement that all teachers who become faculty have to be certified in Alaska, all faculty on at least at the University of Alaska Southeast.
Okay.
Have to be certified in elementary, secondary, special ed, if they're in special ed, that kind of thing.
Okay, Representative Roses.
Thank you. Could you differentiate for me the number of students that you have that are participating in the Master of Arts in Teaching, the five-year program, as opposed to those that are doing it in a four-year program?
I can differentiate at our university. At the University of Alaska Southeast, we have about 100 students who are in the undergraduate program, the elementary ed program. That is not 100 full-time students. Many of those are taking classes at a distance. They may be working in the school district and so on. We have it in any given year over 50 students in the Masters of Art of Teaching, and so those go through in 1 year and, of course, graduate immediately that year. So we're able to produce about 50. We produce about 80 first-year teachers in elementary and secondary through our Masters of Art of Teaching programs. We have three of those. We also have a two-year distance program that enables students to do that if they're working, because some students are working.
Follow-up, Representative Roses.
Thank you. And is it true in your program, as it is in the one that I was familiar with in Anchorage, that the only ones that get that that year-long internship are the ones that are in the MAT program, and also the ones that are in that program are the ones that part of that internship is their several weeks of participation in the rural communities? Is that true?
It is true that we do not require of the undergraduate program the full year internship. It's more of a semester internship. And, in all honesty, I think the full year internship is stronger than the half. Although in the undergraduate program, there are requirements, course requirements in the semester, junior and senior years, in their other semesters to actually be placed in the classroom. So they do get classroom time, but the internship is still a one-semester internship. Am I correct on that? Yeah.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, to get some clarification, on page 1 here on line 11, we're saying that the report must include an outline of the university's past, current, and future plans. Do you interpret past as going back to the advent of the university, or is this a recent past, or how do you and the sponsor both interpret that report requirement?
I have to admit, I'm not clear on past. I think current and future would work for me and be in terms of what's going on in the university, and we could include some programs that have worked and been best practices in the past, but I think to go through all the past probably would be burdensome for us as well as the legislature if we were to go all the way back and do that.
And Madam Chair,
could
we have the sponsors' representative?
Sure, Tim, go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think that maybe that if we go a little bit further on line 12, that we might point out that we're talking about the past known teacher employment vacancies. It can be presumed that in the past they didn't know what those vacancies were and dismiss it on that note. Otherwise, this could be a one-time event to catch everyone up on the history of the teacher industry and then copy and paste it thereafter. once the past has been reconciled, I don't think it would need to be updated.
To that point.
On that point, Representative Roses.
We've had a teacher placement service in the state as long as I can ever remember. So we do have data that indicates what kind of placement has been made. We have data that indicates what kind of vacancies we have that have gone unfilled. I mean, this has gone on and been reported for years, so this really isn't anything new. But, I mean, going back 10 years isn't going to do any good. I would think that if you're looking at five-year look forward, that one would anticipate you wouldn't look back more than 5 years. But, again, this isn't clear, but we do have that information that goes back forever in the teacher placement program.
And follow up.
Go ahead,
to the
Tim.
Chair. It might be worth to. I personally wasn't at all of the task force hearings, but this came out of the task force. Perhaps you might recall better than me how it got there in the first place.
Representative Seaton.
Madam Chair, yes, I don't. You know, this was an initiative to try to generate a report on what we can do to improve teacher training. And the reason I'm bringing this up is to get on the administrative record, because at least when I voted for this in the task force, and I think, you know, Representative Roses was on the task force as well and can give his opinion, but, you know, the intent here is not to go back and have a report that says what we did 15, 20 years ago, because what we're talking about is our current situation and how are we currently and what are our future plans for closing the training, the attraction and retention of teachers. So I just want to make sure that we either change that in here or clarify it or get it on the record anyway as to what the intention of this term past is.
And I'm wondering if we could just delete it. Report must include an outline of the university's current and future plans. You know, and maybe not even have the word past in there.
Madam Chair.
On that point, Representative Seaton.
On that point, I don't think that there's anything that's going to prevent them from talking about things that they've been doing to do it. So we'll probably look at that.
Representative Gardner, then you're next. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I guess current and future plans. I don't know what the difference is between a current plan and a future plan. So we might play with those words a little bit. But what I was going to ask about is recruitment. There are a lot of fields or areas of employment in the state where we've made an effort to recruit local people because they're more likely to stay in their own communities. And I think dental health aides, rural dental health aides is an example of that. With the nursing program where we have satellite campuses focusing on doing a lot of work there, people that come to Anchorage and get their nursing credentials might be more likely to stay in their local communities, go back home. Do we have any active efforts to recruit people from small communities, rural Alaska, and encourage them or assist their efforts to get teaching credentials?
That's a question.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Gardner, we actually have a future teachers program in Alaska, and we have it in a number of the rural communities. In fact, those students will be here soon for a statewide meeting, and there'll be, I can't remember the exact number of students coming in, and they actually plan to visit the legislature, but we do have future teacher programs throughout the state. We have them at Mount Edgecombe, for example, and a number of the other rural communities. So we've been trying in terms of recruiting the high schools. We do it in Southeast through, for particularly in rural areas, through our Preparing Indigenous Teachers program. We have a grant to do that. We bring in native teachers, native students from all over Southeast and YK Delta area to look at training for teachers. And we have in each of those high schools identified teachers in the high school who are interested in working with students and helping them to take the coursework that's required to be a good teacher, to prepare in order to come. And so they work with the students in there. We have a couple meetings a year with those mentors in those high schools that are working with those students. And then each year we have about 25, 30 new students that come in. Not all of those end up becoming teachers, but most of them do remain and end up getting degrees, which, again, is very important to me for the Native population in Alaska.
Thank you. Follow-up. Madam Chair, I assume that the report then will include the history of that with the numbers and the effectiveness. And thank you.
And then Representative Rose is on that point.
Yes. When I was involved with the university and before we developed the statewide mentorship program, one of the things that we talked about was how do we get the rural teacher aides to be able to then go back and get their certification to become a teacher. One of the huge obstacles that we run into is we have plenty of interest, but they do not have the ability to be able to follow through in the communities in which they live to be able to get the degree. We do a lot of online courses. We do distance learning. But then when they have to uproot and leave their communities and their families and with no source of income to be able to then travel to the university where they can finish up the remaining 2 years of their degree, that's where we lose them. So there has been attempts to try to accommodate that situation for years, and we run up against the university requirements for becoming a certified teacher, as well as the inability for many of those folks to be able to afford to leave their families and travel to the university to complete it. So it isn't from lack of discussion, or it isn't for lack of attempts to try to get there. It's just the inability for the two opposing forces to somehow come together and make it happen. So unless there's some kind of subsidy that's provided to where people can afford to leave their communities, I don't think you're ever going to see that change. As much as we talk about it, it just makes it very difficult.
Chancellor?
Yes, through the chair. Representative Roses, I would say that there have been a lot of attempts, and there still are. For example, I mentioned our Bachelor of Elementary Education actually can be taken distance at anywhere throughout the state. But the issue that you still have is if you want good teachers, they're still going to have to take content coursework at some levels. And it's not impossible, but in some fields, for example, secondary education, which we now have the federal requirement for adequately prepared teachers, you have to have a degree or a major in a given field in order to teach in a high school in that area. If it's math, if it's, you know, if it's history, it's biology, so on. That is very difficult in a state of our size to be able to accommodate every single person in their, you know, in their locale to do that. So I agree that it's in some ways the attack, and I'm sure in the report we'll deal with some of that. It's going to have to be both. I mean, and you can do some of it, and people can go back home and finish up, you know, their final couple of years working in the classroom and taking method courses and so on. But some of the content stuff is difficult for them to get without going to a university and finishing up. To get a major in a certain area is not easy to be able to do in every area. So I that's going to continue to be a challenge for us at the secondary level. I think in the elementary area we've made more inroads and have done better in that area. But I don't disagree with you that it is there's still a lot of tension around that and trying to get that done.
Representative Kelly.
Could we have a brief at ease? I'd like to talk to the representative of the sponsor. We talked before, and I just want to clarify something that I understood him right.
Brief at ease.
My concern, I have a concern, and that is that this is more than a report. That's what I'm concerned about. And the reason I say that is that it talks about the plans and the strategies here, future plans, short-term, down at the bottom of the page there, line 14, short-term and five-year strategies with accompanying budgets. So we're talking in a way here, we're either suggesting or implying or assuming the university is going to do something new and spend some money. And certainly we're going to see this again in the operating budget the way, you know, and I'd like to get that clarified in my head because from the testimony that we got from the university on the fiscal note, they were talking about it as a report. But that certainly goes, to my mind, goes beyond that, so.
Do either one of you who were on the committee have any comments to that?
I do.
Representative Rosen.
This came up. We had 12 meetings, 11 meetings or something altogether. This came up as about a 30-minute discussion in one meeting. So it wasn't something that we spent a tremendous amount of time dwelling on, but the concern that came up was how good a job is our university system in the state of Alaska doing to help us fill the education gap? And so out of that came the idea of let's make sure that each year we have a report as to how we are trying to close the gap. It was nothing more than that. It didn't go into any more detail than that, and that was the intent of the committee. Can we get a report that tells us what have we been doing, how well are we accomplishing an objective, what do we need to do differently to make sure that we can try to close that gap? That was it. And it really didn't go much more than that kind of a discussion, and for not much longer than what it just took me to tell you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, I agree with that, and I think that we should look at this in context. We were also discussing about the Standing Committee on Education, and we wanted to not be behind the eight ball. We wanted to have the university coming to the Standing Committee of Education, presenting those, that information, plans, strategies, so that we could be accomplishing the goal of, because we definitely identified that teacher training and the gap in retention and hiring of teachers was something that was affecting education in the state of Alaska. Our job on the task force was funding, and there were a number of issues that came up that were not funding issues but were highly important to education, and most of those we wanted to address by a standing committee on education that would take the time to devote to these things. And this was, as Representative Rosa said, one of the things that would be a input piece and bring the university board of regents to the table and seeing how we could go forward. So if I mean that would be my response to that, but it was about the length of the conversation we've been talking about.
Representative Rosa.
I'll just add one little piece. The main focus was on the education funding and not on the other issues. But if you recall, and you've probably heard me say this a number of times in committee as well as on the floor, one of the reasons we worked so hard to try to get the funding over a multi-year program was so that we no longer have to only talk about education in terms of funding, that the committee was being created, and there were several issues that we brought forward that we thought that the committee should start to take a look at, not the least of which was the teacher retention, attraction, and training. The other pieces, of course, was them talking about charter schools and correspondence schools. The other piece we talked about, and there were quite a few of them, but these were the kinds of things that we wanted to put in place and make it clearly understood that we would hope that by doing a multi-year funding mechanism so that we aren't spending all of our time talking about that, we can get into substantive issues as to how we start looking at education to determine whether or not we are moving things in the direction we wanted. This was just one piece of that, as Representative Seaton said. So that was it. I mean, there was really nothing sinister or nothing clandestine. It was just saying we want a report so we know where we are and what we need to do to close the gap. And so,
Representative Keller.
Yeah, and I certainly didn't mean to intimidate us. There was something bad going on here. But I do have some amendments I'd like to make later on when we get to that point, and I just wanted that clear when we got there. And I have another question, a little different topic. I think that clarifies in my mind. Is back up on line 10, where it says describes the efforts of the university. I'm presuming, in talking with the representative of the sponsor of the bill here, that we want reported everything that's going on, not just the university. So it would seem to me like it would be better worded to say that describes efforts to attract, train, and retain. So that what that would do is encourage or assume that the university is in communication with K-12 on this and going to doing some reporting on what's going on in K-12, maybe a little bit. So that's
say that again.
If they are reporting the efforts to attract, train, and retain, they may report some things that, like that the K-12 system is doing to attract, train, or retain, along with what the university is doing, and maybe not. But that's what I understood. The sponsor wanted was report and kind of a collaboration there on the K-12N. But if we could hear from the sponsor's representative, I'd appreciate it on that.
Okay, Tim.
Through the chair. If first I could respond to the first comment Representative Keller made about and that the two members of the task force responded to. I agree. I think they answered your question for me pretty much, that the task force and this bill is intended to provide not only the other legislation that sets up a standing education committee, but also via this bill creates a forum for us not to talk about budgets and money, which we commonly do with the university subcommittee of finance, but this would allow for us to talk about substantive educational policy issues, to clarify or rephrase what you gentlemen stated. Secondly, then, if you're suggesting that we move towards striking of the university, I think it would change the title if we include Department of Education. I believe that it was the task force's intention to make this as simple as possible, and that it's implicit in this bill that the university would need to hold hands with the department, or that the university report back to us at a board-to-board level as to how the university is holding hands with other departments in addressing this workforce issue.
And on that point, Representative Rosen.
Thank you. And if we get to the point that becomes an amendment, I will have a considerable amount more to say on it. But the reason that we're asking the Board of Regents to report what they do, there are so many issues that are involved in teacher retention, especially in the rural areas, none the least of which are living conditions, housing conditions, and the working conditions, the relationship that they have with the people in the community. I mean, I can tell you the stories go on and on and on and on. So if you take the university out of that, then you're expecting the Board of Regents to report to us what the housing shortage is in rural communities for teachers. And so I would think that gets it way outside the scope of what the intent of this bill was. So that would be my caution in that.
Are you finished, Representative Keller?
Yes, that clarifies a lot for me. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Faircloth.
Madam Chair, the sponsor of the bill put his hand up. Do you want me to ask?
Oh,
or
I'm
do you
sorry.
Want to
I didn't see him.
Follow up on the comment by Representative Keller regarding accompanying budgets. I think it's also assumed that or fair to allow the university to present a budget if indeed there comes a time when they feel like they would like to discuss a new program. A budget is just a request. I don't think it would impose upon the legislature or the education committee to endorse a budget or a funding request, but I just wanted to offer that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern and my comments align more closely with Representative Keller. I'm concerned that we're setting a false expectation for a possibility of growth inside of the university system by presenting us with options for retention. So if we're going to do that, there needs to be measurable outcomes so that the funding can be retracted if it's extended on the options if you're going to present budgets. So just for the legislative history record, the university presenting budgets is not really what I want to see at all. I want to see what they're doing to retain, attract, train, and retain qualified public school teachers. And then if they want to provide a menu of options that have an attached fiscal note to it, then I want to see what measures that they are going to measure that investment with for success. So I just don't want to create a false expectation in what we move through committee that they think that means we're supporting an increase to the budget, because I sat on the university's subcommittee budget review, and I just, for those of you who didn't, their budget has increased 50% in 4 to 5 years, and their student population has not. And so they have added over 80 programs. I think the number was 100 that was presented to us, and they have only ramped down 4. So if the Board of Regents in their wisdom presents us budgets with options, understand that when we start down those paths, that for the university to roll back that, it takes them years to do. So if they offer a program for expanding a teacher's program and they allow students to enter that particular track, the thought coming back to us when we're looking at their expansion in their GF funding was that they couldn't withdraw the programs because they had, 26 students in the university system on it, and we are going to maintain the curriculum for that program to the best of their ability. They made a promise. They are extending the promise. We just had that conversation about our military. I think that that is great to have that as a goal. But a 50% growth in GF funding in such a short period of time is a lot of money. And so that's why I'm hesitant to have the university do provide us the details, because all I see is dollar figures. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess
just a second. Tim wants to say something.
If I might offer through the chair, I think Representative Fairclough has just offered the potential for a committee letter of intent that I'd be happy to draft on behalf of the committee.
Okay. Madam Chairman, I'm happy to support understanding and retaining and keeping teachers in the state of Alaska, and I want good housing and all of those things. It's just that we have to find a way, when we put a business plan together, that we have accountability and that we're actually producing something at the other end, because while we've made a promise to 26 students, it might be cheaper to send them out of state to another program than continuing to offer it in the state of Alaska. And I don't, you know, I certainly don't want to export students that are in our university, but the bottom line is a 7% reduction in oil production. 90% of our budget is based on that. How do we get our costs under control? And, you know, I want to invest in education. So it is my intent to understand what the university does, as well as K through 12, but I don't think K through 12 is here with outcome measures for any of their alternatives that have budget implications. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Sisson, if you would proceed.
Thank you. And actually, this is a continuation of the discussion that we've been on, so it really is on point. I am somewhat, and I think some of the discussion about the foundation for this effort got to the issue, but the kind of loose way that the regents are in this bill supposed to give a, and we've kind of mentioned it twice, do the university's past, current, and future plans, and that to me does seem somewhat loose. In that, and I guess this is kind of the difference of perspective here, and I kind of have a very strong bias because I've been, 2 years ago was when I gave up being a student, so at my advanced age, it's been many, many years of this, but I think it's the only way we're going to make it forward on actually changing our educational system is actually to have the university do this kind of reporting, but the report to me, I would want there to be outcome measures in the report, not necessarily a heavy science modeling program that you're trying to go after, but nonetheless, with each one of these plans that the university comes up with, and then it's reporting after the fact what they've done, that there be some not financial, but rather the outcomes in terms of success. Chancellor Pugh may be the person to answer that.
Are you here with your...
Yeah, well, he's ready to answer.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm not really finished.
Representative Sisson, I think that is the whole point of our performance-based budgeting that we've been presenting to the legislature. And, for example, where most of the money has been put in recent years is in health care, and we can show you the enormous increase in graduates now. We've doubled the number of nurses. You know, we've more than tripled all of the graduates from our other health science programs, and we're continuing. We have a waiting list of 800 for the nursing program, Anchorage's nursing program around the state. So that is something that the university has been committed to and continues to commit to. I think what you'll see in this report, the very first report, is you'll get all the programs and you'll get all the graduates in every area. And there are, areas that are are more difficult. For example, special ed. General special ed, we have a good graduation rate. When you get down to specialized areas in special ed, which are required by the federal government, the Alaska small population, it is a lot more difficult to look at, you know, how many are you going to graduate, that kind of thing. But we will give you those numbers in every single program throughout. I mean, that to me and Pat Pitney was here, who's head of our budget, is also institutional research. We have all that data, and that will be put. If we do new programming, when we ask for budget programming, we do have to put down what are we predicting are going to be the number of students in each of those programs, and how at what year will we reach those, you know, those figures. So, for example, the fisheries undergraduate program right now, with the request they have, they're saying in 5 years they'll have 100 students in their undergraduate fisheries program with that increase that they've gotten from Rasmussen, and they're asking the legislature to match. That is the example of how we do budget now, and we will continue to do that. We would do this in the report.
Right. A follow-up, Representative Sisson.
Thank you very much. And that is, actually, I would expect no less from the university. But I guess what my concern is in the legislation, that we put it in a way that models what we want in legislation. And that, in fact, that is exactly what we need to do if we're going to really solve the problem, not just in this legislation, but other legislation as well. And so I would hope that we can do some amendments that actually craft it just exactly right. And I think the sponsor and the chancellor and others might be able to suggest some language that would be perfect.
Representative.
It's truly a question, not a comment.
Keller.
For my clarification, I was under the impression that mentoring program was a K-12 program, and I just can't pull it back. I'm needing some help to know how the university's in on that.
Through the chair. Yes, Representative Keller. The university got involved at the request of the last Commissioner of Education, and in order to help put funding together from the federal government and from the state to provide a mentoring program in which the university actually hired the mentors, the teachers, and so on, and then also worked towards adopting the criteria and standards for mentors, how we were going to do that. So the university is involved as administratively we run the program, but the actual mentors are all master teachers from all throughout the state, from various districts and so on. They are not faculty. There are faculty involved, and we have in this case a faculty member who does all the research on following these to make sure that the program is effective. In other words, have we really increased the retention of students of the new teachers by having the mentoring program? So we have an ongoing research project with this to ensure that there is a follow-up on it. And that's how the university involved. It's not university faculty doing the mentoring. It's actual K-12 teachers who have been hired from the districts to do that. And they were recommended by the districts, it's because they were master teachers.
Thank you.
Can I add to that?
Representative Roses.
Actually, it had its impetus back when Shirley Holloway was the commissioner, so it was several commissioners ago. And there was a program that was a grant that was awarded through the university, and it was the grant that was for the teacher enhancement program. And I happened to sit on that board for several years. And one of the things that they were responsible for was establishing what best practices were for teachers. And in so doing, it became became pretty obvious to those of us that were working on that we needed to institute statewide what best practices were. And then how do you go about measuring those practices? And then how do you help bring teachers up to speed as to what the best practices are? And out of that burgeoned a teacher mentoring program in the Anchorage School District that was brought about after Contract 2000 was negotiated, which I happen to know a little bit about since I was a negotiator. And so we instituted the mentoring program in Anchorage, and We started then working on a statewide mentoring program through this teacher enhancement program that was a grant from the federal government. And part of that was sending teachers to a training outside as to how do you implement best practices. They then brought that back, created the statewide mentorship program, which took place over a little over 2 years to develop what the criteria would be and how people would be trained and how would they go out into the bush communities and assist. And from that, we developed a list of, quote, what were called master teachers that would be the ones that would serve as the mentors to go out into the different areas to provide services to the mentees. And at that time, we realized there wasn't the possibility of serving everybody in the district, so it was restricted to those that were in their first or second year of teaching. And that's how the program got started, and it has sort of taken as an offshoot from that. And then as that grant money ran out, then it became necessary for the state to replace those funds, and that's where the state-funded mentorship program came into being. And so that's sort of how it got to the point that we're at now. And it's still only probably in the infancy of where we had anticipated that it would grow to, but it's serving a good purpose and having some good results.
Chancellor, I have a question. We've had it in the mentoring program has been in effect for 2-3 years now?
A little longer than that, Madam Chair. Probably 5 years, and Anchorage had it first, and then I'd say statewide it's been in effect about 3 years.
3 years, okay. Are we hitting every new teacher, or are we not?
No. We're hitting, I think, the figures I saw is about 70%. I think it's in that neighborhood at this point. But we are seeing results that those individuals that are mentored versus those that are not, we have a higher retention rate, which that's the national figures are the same. Mentoring, a lot of states have gone to mentoring program to try to help new teachers to really make it through those first couple of tough years, which there are a lot of tough issues in the classroom in those first couple of years.
Yeah, I've talked with some of them, and some of them said I would have quit in the middle of my first year if I wouldn't have had the mentor, somebody to call and say, what am I going to do now? I handled it bad. I know I did. What do I do or whatever,
Follow up on that.
Follow up, Roses.
The ultimate goal is for every first-year teacher to have a mentor, and we have now expanded that to include actually mentoring for principal as well as, believe it or not, mentoring for superintendents that are new to the state. And so, unfortunately, since we don't have the ability to provide one for every new teacher, unfortunately what happens is, as the evaluation processes start to come forward in the early part of the year in which they're teaching, there are those teachers that recognize it having areas of deficiency. And so then, to address those, they are put on what one would consider as a plan of improvement, for lack of a better term. There's a technical process that you go through. The first is called a plan of support, and that's where the mentor comes in. And then after the mentor works with them, if we don't see marked improvement in what they're doing in the classroom in terms of best practices, then they get put on a plan of support. If they're not able to then improve instruction and be able to change behavior in the classroom in terms of accomplishing the objectives, then at the end of the as you move forward, at the end of the designated time on a plan of support, then they're given a letter of non-retention. So that's sort of the process. So the earlier you can intervene with the mentor, the less likely you are to get somebody on the plan of support and therefore get a letter of non-retention. So the earlier, the better. But it unfortunately doesn't always work that way.
Okay. Representative Cisna, then Representative Fairclough.
Yeah, I'm really fascinated by this because it feels as if there's part of the history here that just was left out of, maybe I'm wrong, but there was this grant that went in place and a huge effort was put forward, and it feels like this bill is something that's grown out of that sort of a while after the fact, no? But it is true that the mentoring program that the university is really working on is something that was that springs from the work that was done in the late 1990s that Representative Roses was a part of.
Well, if
am I
may,
right?
Representative Roses.
Thank you. It actually was in early 2000.
Okay.
I don't want to mislead you and say that the grant was only for teacher mentoring. It wasn't. The grant was specifically designed to try and determine what best practices were, and then how do we train teachers along those best practices in terms of meeting the standards and the goals that the state of Alaska had set for educational standards. And
now, do we need this for this bill?
Yes.
Okay.
It's the department. But the other part of that was that the university then had to realign their curriculum to make sure that the teacher training program also taught teachers the best practices to get to those standards. So this has nothing to do with that at all. This is just a report on what are you doing to attract and retain. And so that may be a piece of it. They may go back and refer to the grant. But this was not just for teacher mentoring. It was also for the university to align their standards practices and how they teach teachers so that when they go out, they are teaching to the best practices. So it was training for university professors as well as the folks that are in the K-12 education system. Because as part of that grant, there was a university professor would travel out to the different schools to work with the mentors to make sure that they were working along the same line. And then they would come back to the university in the evening and report back as to what the standards were, and they had open discussions, et cetera, et cetera. So that's only a small piece of this. That's just one of the pieces that they would report in there as to how that program was working.
Representative
Sisson. Madam Chair, I'm not going to say anything else until we actually are discussing, but it does, as a matter of fact, to me, point to why this is an important piece of legislation in that it does continue work that has been in place. And until we actually get past the point of having grants that have programs for a couple of years and then it dissipates and nothing else happens, and that's happened a lot of times, this is something that's continuing and we need to keep it in place. Thank you.
Any other comments? And did I hear someone say that they had some amendments? Okay, I'm ready for amendments.
I would really like to
up the testimony.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Representative Keller.
I would really like to have a little bit of time. I'm really struggling with the concept. It's a great, I'm all for the report. Hey, of course, let's get it. And I'm all for the idea of keeping the program going. But the section of law this is in is not programs. And this is more than a report. When you ask for plans, strategies, and budget, that fits into the program portion of the University of Alaska. And that's fair. And then we're talking a fiscal impact and everything else. But I don't want, the reason I'm struggling is it just seems like we're doing more. 190, the first part here that is being added to the part B, is nothing more than a report on what the university is doing with its money and its facilities. There's nothing in there that says that we want a plan here and we want what you're going to do and we want a budget, and it's not proactive. This section that we're trying to force in there, it seems to me like we're doing more than just a report.
What page are you on? Where are you at right now?
Where am I at? where section one there, where it says 1440-190 is amended by adding a new subsection. There's if you look in there now, what is there becomes A. So,
no, A is right over here. Mm. Well, we've got A here.
As I understand it, we're leaving what 1440-190 in there, and that becomes A, and this is a new B. And what I'm questioning is whether it's a proper drafting practice here to put something in here that is more than a report.
Madam Chair. That was a decision, Tim Lampkin here, that was a decision made by the bill drafter. In discussing it with them, that was the most appropriate location in statute to put this report. And I think that I can speak on behalf of Senator Stevens when it comes, if it would help the committee, I think that friendly amendments would include striking accompanying budgets and or striking the reference to past plans. But again, I just would like to, if we're talking about amendments now, like to suggest that, you know, it is a value to folks to have a review of the past, of what we've done in the past, so if and when there were mistakes made, we don't repeat those mistakes. I believe Representative Sisto, and we all got a bit of a learning lesson or a history lesson today on the mentoring project. And so that in defense of keeping the word past in there, I personally feel that that could be just a one-time event, that it could be made once, and then from the past won't change after that one report is made. Well, thereafter, it could be just referred to.
You have to realize that every 2 years there'll be new people on that committee.
Well, right. It could be literally copied and pasted into a report.
Okay, you know what? I think there's enough maybe concerns on this that maybe we need to hold it and look at it over. I want Representative Keller to get with you and to see if you can work out something that you're happy with. And Seaton,
I want to offer an amendment
right now.
Sure.
Well, let's wait until we bring it up again the next time, if that's all right with you. I'd really like to get the other one up and talked about, so that you know. But if that, you know, that's kind of a decision I've made. Yes, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to see the letter too, as far as the intent. If we could have that from the sponsor, and then. For the record, what I might propose to try to satisfy some of my concerns is, instead of with accompanying budgets, maybe it should say with accompanying fiscal notes, because my thought process, I want to see the menu options. I don't want to just see an expansive budget. I want options with measurements. So if we can do X to produce an improved retention rate, then I want to know the fiscal note that's accompanying it versus a budget, which seems more encompassing to me than the cost. I'd like bite-sized pieces so I could choose what I would want to implement, or so future legislators could choose, versus budgets that are integrated and somehow you can't do X without Y, Z, L, and P, and then we can't take it apart.
Okay.
Thank you.
And Representative Roses.
When you asked Representative Keller to get together with the bill sponsor, was that with the intention of them doing an amendment or working on a CS? Because if they're going to CS, it might be helpful if we had the basis of what
I'm just looking at amendments right
okay,
now.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So, anyway, Tim, you know which ones had the concerns, and if you can get with them and see what the sponsor would be okay with, and yet something that will really satisfy the committee. All right?
Okay.
Okay, thanks. And now we will go to Senate Bill 119. And Senate Bill 119 is our last bill. It's the school library grants. There's a new fiscal note and a sectional handed out. And Jenny, you're going to be in place of your senator. And so if you would come forward and present your bill.
Thank you. I'm Jenny Osterman, staff to Senator Donald Olson. SB 119 establishes both the Public Library Construction and Major Expansion Grant Program and the School Library Collection Development Grant Program. Both grant programs are subject to appropriation. In the Library Assistance Grant Program, the state would match up to 50% of the cost of new library construction or major expansion in communities with a population of 10,000 or less. The local government would be responsible for securing a match of at least 20%, and the remainder can be provided by private donors. The Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development will administer the grants and promulgate regulations to establish ranking criteria. The Public School Library Collection Development Grant Program establishes a maximum grant of $3,000 for a fiscal year to a public school library that is deemed eligible by the grants administrator. The grants administrator will be the First Nord Division in charge of the state library. The funds are to be used for expanding the library collection materials, meaning books, magazines, reference and audiovisual material, and electronic subscriptions that support school curriculum and student reading activities such as software that is student-oriented, like an e-book or databases. Grant money awarded under this program may not be used to purchase classroom materials, textbooks, testing software, library automation software, computer hardware, operating software, or technology support. The grant is established in the Department of Education. And just to clarify that particular point on the computer software and hardware. Automation software, operating software, computer hardware, and technology support are already funded with federal money or private contributions in the school districts in Alaska. Grant recipients shall prepare an annual report to the department describing the effects of the grant and whether all conditions of the grant were met or exceeded. If the funds appropriated for this grant program are not sufficient to fund all eligible grant requests, the available funds shall be paid out on a pro rata basis to grantees. And Senator Olson is in a transportation subcommittee finance hearing right now. They're closing out. I apologize for that.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On the sectional that we have, is that refers to Section 1 as a school program. Is that?
Actually, I think you might have the old sectional. That's the old sectional. There was a new sectional. New I apologize for that.
It's over here.
This is the new one?
Yes,
the new one.
That's the new one.
Here
it is. You can take
a copy. Thank you, Madam Chair. Another question. So, as I'm reading the bill, and do we have version L before us? Is that what, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Okay. It seems like when I read Section 1 and 2, or Section 2 here on line 12, it's the Manchin Grant Program for Library Construction and Major Expansion, and then the definition of major expansion over on the means an expansion to the existing library to increase the square footage of the structure but not less than 30%. So as I read the bill, it's not the materials or any of the software or anything else, it's this money could only be used for construction and major expansion.
There are two components to the bill.
Section 3.
Sections 1 and 2
okay.
Are the construction components. Section 3 is the, and I would clarify also that Sections 1 and 2 speak to public libraries. Section 3 speaks to school libraries. And so the materials part portion, when you're speaking of materials such as magazines, atlases, et cetera, that's Section 3 and that's school libraries.
Thank you. Follow up?
Please, go ahead.
So the program then for community libraries is only for square footage expansion of the physical buildings and the materials is only applicable to school libraries.
That's correct. And somewhere, I hope I have, Darwin Peterson from Senator Stedman's office is also here. He can speak to the construction portion of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I had a question as well. So can you tell me, the restriction is that it is in communities with a population of less than 10,000. Is it not possible for the school libraries to be considered the public libraries for those communities? Or are we talking about having to build a public library in every community?
No, you're correct. Many times the school libraries are the public library.
And do we know whether or not if you are expanding or remodeling and you have construction costs that are related to schools, do they not currently qualify for matching funds under the state? Some are 70%, some are 60, some are 50, depending on the type of construction.
I would ask if Darwin could come forward and speak to that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For the record, Darwin Peterson, staff to Senate Finance Committee under Senator Stedman. The answer to your question is yes, there are school libraries that would qualify for construction or major expansion under other sections of statute. The intent with sections 1 and 2 for public construction of public libraries are for those communities that don't have public libraries. The conversation in the Senate Finance Committee when these sections were included were that a lot of the small communities, if they can attract outside philanthropic private funds to help construct the libraries, that they should be encouraged to do that if they don't have a public library in their school. One of the reasons was they don't want the public in the school, in the school libraries. They want the public to have a public library that they can go to. So the intent with these sections is to construct public libraries that are owned by the municipalities or the community and not attached to the school, not a part of the school.
Representative Fairclough, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For clarification, I thought I heard you say that if funds were not enough to meet the needs of the grants out there, that it would be prorated and distributed on a pro rata basis?
That's correct for the material portion.
For the materials portion. If I could point you to, that's for the library collection itself.
Yes.
So if I could point you to line on page 2, lines C, 3031, and then it goes over to the top of page 3, it says it's by the highest ranked applicants, which is what I support, not the pro rata.
Okay. I stand corrected.
Just wanted to make sure.
It's a different version of it, and I apologize.
No, I just wanted to, because I did support that language, so I wanted to make sure if I didn't have the right version. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. For communities less than 10,000, we've got a number of them that are, definition community is 25 people within 2.5 miles of each other that are, you know, and often they're unincorporated communities. And they have a 501(c), they have a library associated. On page 2, on line 11, where we say publicly owned and operated, do we have a definition of there that would allow something other than a municipal government to qualify as publicly owned and operated?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. It would be, according to legislative legal, it would be any community, town, city, municipality, state, any public entity could own or operate one of these libraries if the rest of the eligibility criteria are met.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I guess I'm trying to find out if we have a community that's an unincorporated community, and sometimes, I have, Seldovia Village is 1,900. We have 2,000 people in Anchor Point, and they have a small community library. But I'm trying to figure out how, if you have a nonprofit, do nonprofits then automatically qualify as public ownership?
Through the chair, no.
Okay, so then, Madam Chair. So then, that's what I think I'm hearing is that unless you are an incorporated municipality, I don't think you can ever qualify for one of these grants because there's no public ownership, even if it's a native tribe or a native corporation, that's not public ownership. So was that the intention, or was the intention to have it so that if there's some form of community ownership other than forming a municipality, that would be allowed to be able to get a grant?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, the intent was to allow any community that has the means to partner with the state and private entities to construct a public library in their community. So in your example, Anchor Point would be able to partner with the state and a private entity to construct or majorly expand their existing library if they currently have one. And they would be eligible. So you don't have to, this is not in any way trying to encourage or push unincorporated Alaska into forming municipalities. If the small communities are able to contribute 20% of the total construction cost, then, and show that they can own and operate it, then that community would be eligible. So a lot of the really small communities would probably not be eligible simply because of the fact that they wouldn't have the necessary infrastructure in their community to own and operate a public library or to even come up with the 20% matching funds.
Follow up?
Yep, Representative Steven.
So I guess I'm really still at an odds here of public ownership. I mean, if you have a non-incorporated community, how do you establish public ownership? Normally, public ownership is a, you know, library corp, so they form a little 501(c) so that it's, you know, has a nonprofit community ownership, but there isn't any. I'm trying to figure out the structure, so I would, maybe we can investigate this a little further, because I think that the way this is written, it only allows public ownership if there's a, if there's a municipality, because if you had a native tribe or a native association, I don't think that's going to be considered public ownership unless we define this differently in this bill. So I'd like to work with you a little bit further on that.
To the chair, I'd be happy to do that. I'll request a legal opinion to define that specific question that you just addressed, and then I can work with your office on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any no questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
I did have another one. The local government entity in an amount not less than 20% of the total project cost. Am I assuming then that you can have 50% matching from the state, and then you would have to, you could get, let's say, 30% from something like the Rasmussen Foundation, but that you would actually have to have a taxing mechanism for 20%, or could you get the Ford Foundation to give you 20%, Rasmussen give you 30%, you know, generated through RFPs and donations to match the 50%. I'm not quite sure how the 20% works.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the intent was to have some sort of a taxing infrastructure in place for the local community to be able to come up with 20% of the total cost of the construction on their own from their own budget. And the other 30% would come from private donors. So the intent wasn't to allow the Rasmussen Foundation to provide 50%, which also covers the community's contribution, and then the state provide the other 50%.
So follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Seaton.
So I guess this kind of gets back to our other point. Is there any, is there any taxing mechanism that would be applicable other than a municipality? I mean, where does the taxing authority originate from, that if we're going to say that they have to come up with 20% of that?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I do believe you're probably correct. We'll clarify that with the legal opinion. But again, the really small communities weren't really part of the conversation when we were talking about public libraries, because it would be very difficult for the small communities without any sort of a taxing mechanism or any budget to own and operate the public library.
Thank you. And we have about 19 people that would like to testify. And, you know, and I would kind of like to go to them right now so that we can get that on. And I'm asking people that are online I'm going to give you a limit of 2 minutes. And so we're going to start right away now, and we'll continue as long as we can. Charlotte Glover from Ketchikan.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Wonderful. Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Charlotte Glover, and I've been the Youth Services Librarian at the Ketchikan Public Library for the past 17 years. I've worked with statewide literacy programs and regional literacy programs, including our own Born to Read program, a statewide Book Bonanza program, which provides money for school libraries, which I started, and have created and founded the chapter of Southeast Alaska First Book, which is a national literacy program. Because of these activities, I see dozens of grant applications a year from school librarians and teachers detailing just how limited their resources are for new books. So I'm going to speak to that section of the bill in particular. In addition, my public library in Ketchikan is part of a consortium which includes seven school libraries and a college library. From my colleagues, I know firsthand how poorly funded the school libraries are in Ketchikan. I admire the local librarians who raise money themselves year after year so their kids can have a few new books on the shelf. My publicly funded public library has more money for books in a year than most school libraries will see in two decades because schools have not made new books for kids and teachers a priority. Partially, I think this is because there's a perception out in the world that kids don't need to or don't want to read in the age of the Internet. So we've been buying computers and software. But nothing could be further from the truth. Our children are dying to see themselves in books and are eager to explore the world through colorful nonfiction and compelling fiction. Circulation has grown every year at my library since I've been here for 17 years in the Internet age. We loan an average of 600 books a month to our school libraries. Teachers and students are borrowing folk tales, fairy tales, holiday books, science fair resources, encyclopedias, books about Alaska Native culture, geography titles, history books, and biographies.
Charlotte, can you sum up? Your 2 minutes are up.
Okay. The summation of that is we can't meet the demand from the public library for all the books the school libraries need, and I think we forget about that when we're surrounded by piles of reading material and overstuffed bookcases at home, that for many, many of the kids in Alaska, their parents do not buy books or bring them to the public library, and the school library becomes their only outlet for recreational and informational reading. This bill would give each of our communities money for desperately needed books and would send a message that we know kids who read achieve. And in Ketchikan, we've been trying to raise money for a decade now for a new library, so I absolutely support any funding for a new library construction as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Rosalind Goodman. Roz?
Yes, I'm on. My name is Roz Goodman, and I've been a school or school district librarian for 36 years, 20 of those working for Alaska school districts, and the last 8 as a library consultant to Alaskan school districts. From my experience, I can tell you that school library collections throughout rural Alaskan schools that I've been to are sorely in need of updating to support and enhance the current curricula and standards. And even more important, to meet the informational needs and read and pleasure reading interests of the students in the school. There's a substantial amount of research which acknowledges the correlation between reading success and library collections that include books that students can and will want to read. And one of those studies was conducted in Alaska in 1999. Based on my work in school libraries, I can honestly say that each and every one would benefit greatly from new books and other relevant library resources. Here is what I see. Most collections are extremely outdated and not in any way in sync with their current state and local school district standards for K-12 students, nor do they coincide with the levels that students are reading at or, even more important, what students are interested in reading. Most collections have not been adequately infused with new books since the original collections and in many of the schools that was from the 80s. Most collections lack current basic reference books. In libraries, I've seen encyclopedias dating back to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, very few past 2000. And while many libraries can contain impressive numbers of books on the shelves, I've weeded many collections using standard criteria and procedures, and in most cases I pull off between 25 and in some cases up to 70% of the books on the shelves. Many books still have territorial school stamps or stamps showing discards from other libraries. And just an example, sometimes I substitute at the school in Pedro Bay where I live, and most recently I had a third grade student trying to find something on the human body system and could absolutely find nothing. And that same day a first grader looked at a globe and pointed to the USSR on a map and asked me what country that was.
Ross, can you sum up?
Yes, I can, yes. So I hope that you can support this act. I think it will ensure that students have access to new books annually. It will encourage students to get excited about reading and spend more time reading, and ensure that a minimum amount of funds is spent on improving library collections every year in every school. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Debbie Edwardson, North Slope Borough.
Yes, hello. This is Debbie Edwardson. Thank you for allowing me to testify before you this afternoon. I'm speaking as a mother, a children's writer, a school board president, and a rural Alaskan resident. First of all, as the mother of seven, I have learned that the single most important academic skill that I can give my own children is to instill in them a love of reading. And as a children's writer, I really do believe that the relationship between a single child and a single book has the power to transform the world. So when I walk through village school libraries and see tattered and outdated books and empty shelves, I know that we're failing our children on a very fundamental level, and I'm always glad to be able to speak out in support of our libraries as I'm doing here today. As a school board president, I've read many of the studies that prove what many of us already knew, that there's a direct correlation between well-stocked libraries and reading ability. And I know that the librarians and educators that are testifying before you today have and will continue to cite some of these studies, that they show that students in the schools with well-stocked libraries earn more, get better grades, and score higher on standardized tests than those in schools with outdated libraries. As a rural resident and as a school board member, I'm also aware of the fact that our village school libraries are our community libraries. Our village schools are community centers, and there are no other sources of books in our villages, so our libraries are of crucial importance in the academic development of our young people. And that's a key interest to those of us who sit on school boards, because according to the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development, fully one-third of Alaska students enter high school not reading at their grade level, and under No Child Left Behind, 44% of Alaska school districts are currently failing to make adequate yearly progress. 79% of those failing are rural districts where scores in reading and writing are especially low.
Debbie,
and I know it seems like it would be a really easy solution,
Debbie,
to tell school districts that they should just allot more of their funding to school libraries.
Can you sum up?
You know, but as school boards, we're beset by numerous unfunded mandates that take precedence. For example, we're required by law to serve special needs students at funding levels that represent only a fraction of what these services actually cost. The money that Senate Bill 119 would provide for library construction and library collections is not all that much. We're forced to spend more than this to bring technology into our schools, which we must do to equip our children
Thank
for the
you,
future.
Betty.
But I just want to make sure that none
Debbie.
Of us make a mistake here, that even if we had the...
Okay. If anyone doesn't get a chance to... If you've got your testimony written down, and because we've said 2 minutes, you don't get a chance to say the whole thing, please fax your remarks to 465-3175. That's 465-3175, because we do want to get the whole thing, but because we're limited to time and the 2 minutes, so when the little bell rings, if you can go ahead and sum up with a couple of sentences, we'd appreciate it. And Representative Gardner, you had a question?
Madam Chair, I was going to ask the exact same thing, because I found Debbie Edwardson's testimony riveting, and I do want to hear the rest of it. I hope she'll send it to us. It sounds like she had it written down.
Yeah, and I hope so too, because it you know, I don't want to not have the committee to be able to hear or be able to at least read all of it.
Madam
so.
Chair,
Yes.
It turns out we have that on our, it was one of the handouts here or today, so we'll get a chance to read it.
So we already have that one. Okay. Thank you, Debbie. Patty Linville from Seward.
Hi, I'm Patty. I'm Patricia Linville, librarian from Seward Community Library. Seward Community Library is much like many small public libraries around the state. We are the only municipally funded public library on the eastern Kenai Peninsula. The next closest is Anchorage, 120 miles away. Yes, we help people find reading materials. We also provide assistance to people wanting tax forms, proctored distance learning school exams, help with PFD online applications, and assist those who are applying for jobs online. Our daily adult crowd uses the computers, the bathrooms, and the sofas as if they were at home. Many do not have these amenities elsewhere. The after-school crowd plays computer games, does homework, or just hangs with their friends until their parents are off work and they go home. Some stay until the library closes. Summer in Seward, of course, brings in visitors and seasonal workers looking for a place to sit out of the rain, check email, download photos, and get directions and information about the area. With 30,000 volumes, six public access computers, a teen area, a children's area, a quote-unquote quiet reading area, and office space cramped into 3,500 square feet, there is little to spare for comfortable meeting space. Imagine trying to get your divorce papers notarized while everyone in the library is listening to your conversation. I'm sure many rumors have been started from eavesdropping on some of these private transactions. Our community has been working on plans to build a new library museum since 2003. We have raised over $100,000 locally for the project. We are not expecting any federal assistance. We are writing grants, applying for loans, and approaching private foundations. The city will assume the operation and maintenance of the facility. If we are given the opportunity to apply for a matching grant from the state, we will certainly do so. Please pass SB 119 so we can. The second part of this bill concerns the abilities of school libraries to keep their collections current and viable. As you know, school funding varies widely throughout the state. Hopefully, that will begin to change after this year's session. A few years ago, our district built a new
Patty,
school.
Can you sum up?
Yeah. SB 119 will help Alaska's libraries, both school and public, become information sources and community centers that are so needed in our small communities. So please pass this bill and ensure an informed future for our state.
Thank you, Patty.
Thank you.
Sue Paulson, Petersburg.
Good afternoon. This is Sue Paulson, a library user in Petersburg, I'm proud to say, over 50 years. As you may have heard by now, this new Petersburg Library project is being pushed along with unremitting effort by the community, the library board, the building committee, the capital campaign committee, the city council, the state library, and the 4-Acre Group. We need the help of the legislature to build this cornerstone of our community. We are ready to do our part, and we are asking for help. Pass this bill, please, with recommendations that funding be attached. And thank you for your efforts in Juneau to use Alaska's resources to provide for the people's needs. Keep plugging, you legislators. Thank you so much. Please pass this bill and attach funding as soon as possible.
Thank you, Sue. Your excitement is catching. Sharon Jung?
As a rural Alaskan physician, I'm involved frontline in the battles against mental illness and substance abuse. Libraries are a preemptive strike. They're places to go, centers of cultural events, sources of accurate information, and opportunities for social interactions. They prevent boredom and provide healthy activities. I hope you legislatures will take this opportunity to improve the quality of life for all of your constituents in the small towns, and I encourage you to pass it.
Thank you, Sharon. Next, Pearl Brower from Beryl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Pearl Brower, and I'm the Special Assistant for External Affairs to the President of Elise Olivet College in Barrow. As a tribal college, we have a mission that is twofold. Our mission one is to educate, our second is to preserve and promote our culture and our heritage. Our community library, the Tezzi Consortium Library, is managed by the college. It's our school library as well as our public library, as well as it manages extra library support in all of our seven other villages on the North Slope. The library is wonderful to preserve our culture. It collects information, and it disseminates this information worldwide, which is very important for us in our promotion of the Inupiaq culture. Since the 89-90 fiscal year, we had 2,733 patrons. In the 98-99 year, we had 13,400 patrons. That year, we moved to the Heritage Center location in Barrow. In 2008, this last year, we have grown to over 70,000 patrons a year, which is an immense increase, and therefore the need for a larger facility and an expansion is necessary. So we support the passage of SB 119 in order to create more space for our youth and for our archive collection. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pearl. David Ongley?
Yes, this is David Ongley. I'm the director of the Tuzzi Consortium
David,
Library.
David, and I'd like to David, I'm sorry, but Representative Seaton has a question for Pearl.
Thank you. Pearl, are you still there?
I am.
Yeah. I was trying to figure out under the reading of the bill the way it is, the eligibility for the school is those grants is that it must be owned by a public school library established and supported by a district, and the construction is grants are if they're municipally owned. So do you fall into those categories? You were talking
we
about.
We do, Representative Seaton, in the sense that our library is part of the North Slope Borough. It's in a North Slope Borough facility, but the college manages it. And through the North Slope Borough, our municipal government, we would be able to apply for these funds.
Okay. Thank you, Pearl.
Thank you.
Sorry for interrupting you, David, and I'll let you go ahead now.
Thank you. I just wanted to address both points of this bill. There's an epidemic afoot, I think, nationally, and school libraries are being cut all around the country. I have just today seen the headline from somebody sent me the Arizona Republic, and the headline is Victims of School Cuts, Librarians. And libraries. And Alaska is really no different. We've seen this on the North Slope with our school libraries. We had, just a few years ago, four librarians and a healthy travel budget for the one librarian to visit all the villages, and she had a budget to buy books, and now all that's gone, and we only have one librarian left in the schools with no budget for books. And I think that one of the finer things you could do is to support the school portion of this bill. The construction portion is something I think that would make uniform funding through the state. I have in front of me a list of libraries that have received funding from the state, and Big Lake, for example, in 2002 received 57% of their funding for their library construction project from the state. The Girdwood Library that's going to be constructed soon is getting state funding over 55%, I think. And the new Homer Library received only 16%. There are other libraries that haven't received anything from the state for their construction project. So I think that support for this project, and we desperately need it, as Pearl mentioned previously, would make this uniform and give every library an equal shot at state funding. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. Judith McQuarrie?
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for staying after to listen to all of the libraries from around the state. From Ketchikan to Barrow, there are numerous municipal libraries that are in desperate need of expansion or new facilities. And as David said, the funding, there has been no grant funding for decades, and it just has depended upon who your legislator is and how powerful they are. And we don't think that that's really the way the state of Alaska wants to fund public library construction. School libraries are covered under the school construction funding program, and public libraries have no alternative. So I'd like you to support the public library construction portion of SB 119. We also need desperately to fund collections for the school libraries. They can build new buildings. There's grant funding for that, but there isn't any program for school library collections, and they desperately need that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judith. Catelyn Dixon.
Hey. Thank you. As Judith mentioned, we are in desperate need of a new library, a new public library here in Ketchikan. When you walk into the building, it's incredibly cramped, and I don't think follows any standards for fairness as far as who comes in and wheelchair access, that sort of thing. Books are everywhere. We really need to have a larger space for our community. I am a school librarian here in Ketchikan. I've been a librarian for 16 years, new to schools. I am now in the Schoenbar Library. Schoenbar Middle School was a very difficult construction project, you might recall from other phone conferences in previous months. We now have a beautiful new building. Through a different grant, we have a beautiful set of new books, but we desperately need, in all of our other schools, funding to fix the rest of our school library collections. I do feel that we are supported very well by our district, by our individual school principals. I am given a budget for new books every year, but it's so, so small, and we barely can keep up with what the kids are demanding from us, the newest Harry Potter, that sort of thing. But we really can't go back and fix the years and years that we've had difficult financial circumstances and have not been able to adequately buy the numbers of books that our children need to be better educated. Thank you.
Thank you, Caitlin. Carrie Sagel.
Hi, Carrie Sagel, teacher librarian at Blatchley Middle School in Sitka. Library books and materials help students prepare to meet the educational standards set by the state of Alaska. In April now, coming up, Alaskan eighth graders will be taking a new standardized test, the science SBAs, in anticipation of that. For the last 3 years, I've been concentrating almost all spending, library spending, on science books, trying to meet teachers' requests for books about astronomy, body systems, animal classification, and plate tectonics. These are books they're using to help students reach the standards. They're using the books to help students learn how information is organized on a page, books they're using to use to teach technical reading. 3 years of this concentrated effort have meant that other areas of the library have been neglected. There are no current books on geology, weather, climate, botany, and physics. There's no money to buy books about mythology and trucks because these subjects are not covered in the curriculum. There's no money to begin buying books in the social studies, the next SBA test to be developed. Nonfiction reading is very important in middle school, especially to boys. What do they see when they come into the library? Very old, crusty, dusty books with outdated information and unattractive covers. There might be a few good books hidden in there, but they may not see them because they've already made a judgment that the library is filled with old, uninteresting books. I've made a 3-year goal to weed out all these moldy, moldy books out of the library. My fear that will be that once I've done that, there will be nothing to replace them. I've weeded today a book about the wonderful technology of the phonograph record, but I don't have a book about laser technology to replace it with. In summing up, if students are to remain readers, if they're to have every advantage in passing their standardized tests, there must be books and materials available in their school library, books that are current, books and materials that are accurate, and books that meet both their curricular and interest needs. Please help make this reality for Alaska students.
Thank you, Carrie.
That was excellent.
Barb Bryson in Valdez.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay. Members of the House Health, Education, and Social Service Committee, I thank you for letting me speak before you today.
I have been in the business of school libraries for the past 27 years. I've worked and supported libraries in a variety of ways. I've been on public library boards, and I've been school and district librarian, as well as serving on the Alaska Association of School Librarians board for the last 8 years. I'd like to focus today on Section 3, which is the school library grant piece. Multiple studies show that a school library program that is adequately staffed and resourced and funded can lead to higher student achievement regardless of the socioeconomics or the education levels of the community, and that comes from a documented piece that's in that testimony you have. School library budgets vary widely in Alaska, with some libraries having zero budget from year to year. Based on statistics from 2004 and 2005 that we received from the state library, the median budget for school libraries nationwide was $9,368. The average budget in the Pacific Northwest was $19,211. And in Alaska, of the 165 public schools who responded to a survey that was put out by the state library in November of 2006, the average total school library budget during the 2006-2007 year was $4,284. Replacing library materials is a very expensive proposition. School Library Journal just recently came out with a report that the average cost of a children's hardback book is now $21. If we were to receive an annual budget of, or an annual grant of $3,000, that could purchase 142 additional books. This may not sound like much, but on an annual basis, this could really help beef up a school library collection. And I think it's important to say that school libraries serve all students and teachers in a school, not just specific programs or classrooms. In 2002, the library information literacy standards were incorporated into the Alaska State Standards, and the mission of these standards states, the school library is the primary source for information and curriculum support.
Barb, can you sum up?
Yeah. Basically, we have put it in play that our state standards see libraries as valuable, but without the money that we are not getting, it's just not, we are not able to support our curriculum needs for in the school. I really believe that both of these grants are vital to our communities, and I really encourage you to look thoughtfully and seriously at passing this bill. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. You can, we can tell that you guys are librarians because you have all had great testimony. So thank you. That's all I have for online. And we have one person in the room, Kathy Buten. I'm probably saying that wrong. Buten.
Yeah.
I'm doing the show and tell portion. That is all right with you. Dear.
I'm Kathy Buten. I'm a librarian here in Juneau in the school system, and I'm also a member of the Governor's Advisory Council on Libraries, but I'm testifying as an individual today.
All right.
I have the roadshow for you. Ta-da! Here's a suitcase. I'd like to take you to these fabulous places on my suitcase, but unfortunately we'll have to do it in your imagination, which is what kids have to do. You know, I have had kids pounding my doors for new books. Harry's a little heavy, so I brought his cover. This costs $34.99 retail. We'd love to get lots more books like this. And with your help, $3,000 can go a really long way. As a matter of fact, we could buy 85 books at this retail value. That's a huge help. Now, I have a lovely book here that I weeded, which you've heard before, about Russia. It was on my shelves, and I've been working really hard to get rid of old, ugly, outdated, crusty, misinformed books. And I have a new book to show you, and it costs $19.99. And at this value of $19.99, you could get about, let me look here, you could get 150 books. That would really go a huge way towards helping our school libraries. Now, we have some wonderful publications called Calliope and Paces and Cobblestone, and last year those cost $29 and some change. The increase for next year, I just worked on the ordering, is $33.95. So you can tell the cost of things are increasing rapidly. But even at that, you could get us, gosh, 88 subscriptions. That would be fabulous, wouldn't it? We wouldn't spend it that way. But that gives you a clue. Now, my teachers are crying for DVDs. We have an old VHS collection. At $25,
could get tons of DVDs. At $60 for Egypt, you know, they found new things there. You could get 50 of those. Have you seen Bill Nye on television? $49.95. You could have 60 of these. And Blue Planet, $64.95, you can have tons. So the good news is you can really help us a lot with $3,000 each.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you had that timed good.
I try.
Is there anyone else in the room that wants to testify? Okay. We will close testimony on this bill, and we will hang on to it, and we will discuss it next time. Okay, thank you. And having said that, thank you so much for all your testimony, and please fax if any of you have it written down. We would love to have it. And the number is 465-3175. And saying that, we are adjourned.
Sounds like a commercial.
You got 2 minutes to get your next
Yes,
phone.
I know.
You can just leave all that stuff. I'll take it for you. Okay.